All right, hello DragonCon, all of you who are in here. This is Hacking 101 Coronavirus Edition. I'm your moderator, Dustin Smith. We're going to start with some introductory questions for our panelists so that you can get to know them. We have Xavier Ash, Ray Kelly, Rebecca Carlson, Keith Watson, and Kurt Opsalt. So why don't we go ahead and start with Xavier? You want to do an introduction of yourself real quick?
Sure. Thanks, everyone. My name is Xavier Ash. I am on the blue team side of things. I've been done a little bit of everything in my career. I'm getting close to my 30-year mark. Been around the Atlanta area for quite a while. Currently in the finance area, so doing running in a couple of teams in the security operations side of things. So yeah, I can talk a lot about working on in the blue team and consulting, engineering, architecture, things like that. So, all right.
Okay, Ray, you're next.
Hey, I'm Ray Kelly, and I'm a principal security engineer with White Hat Security, and most of my background is around development. So, and also application security. So application security is my focus, whether it be DAST, SAST, or mobile type of assessment. So that's kind of where my background is. That's it.
Okay, Rebecca?
So I'm also on the blue team side of the house. I do incident response, and I also kind of borderline do like third level SOC type work. I've done incident response for about 5 years now, and before that I was in vulnerability management. So I kind of bounce around to different areas of information security.
Okay. Keith.
Hi all. I'm Keith, otherwise known as X-Ray if you come to DC 404 meetings. I've been at Georgia Tech for over 30 years. I'm the Information Security Manager at College of Computing, GX Certified Security Incident Handler. In a past life, I was a Navy electronics technician on submarines. I specialized in cryptography and signals intelligence. I'm the sponsor of Gray Hat and Mad Hatters, which is the College of Computing student organization for hacking and information security. I'm the host of the local DEF CON chapter here in Atlanta, DC 404. I moderate the channel IRC channels for both DC 404 and Gray Hat. I'm also one of the moderators on the Atlanta Cybersecurity Engineers Discord server, and I'm a member of Atlanta 2600 group. Also a member of Electronic Frontiers Georgia, and work with Scott all the time, trying to advise the local politicians on technology issues. I'm also co-developer of Network King of the Hill CTF. And for anybody who's interested, we host monthly CTFs at DC 404 and 2600 meetings. Next.
All right. Last but not least, Kurt.
Hey, buddy. My name is Kurt Opsal. I am the Deputy Executive General Counsel, Electronic Frontier Foundation, a nonprofit foundation dedicated to defending your rights online. One of the things I do at EFL is I work on our rights project, where we provide free legal counsel to security researchers who have questions about the quality of research or issues that might arise when we're disclosing vulnerabilities to a vendor to the public. So I guess, unlike everyone on this panel, I'm coming from the legal side, not the technology side. It's a pleasure to be again at Hack 01, and I look forward to folks' a great discussion.
Okay. Now we're going to start with some questions for you guys. So first question I'm going to ask is, what is hacking to you? And we'll start in the same order that you guys introduced yourselves in. So go ahead and start, Xavier.
Sure. So hacking to me, I think, is a mindset. It's basically the idea that you want to generally not only know how something works inside, but also, you know, how can you possibly make that thing do something it wasn't supposed to do? So adding new features, finding out, you know, in particular ways it breaks. But the when somebody calls themselves a hacker, it really to me is more of a mindset on really how you like to learn. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay, right.
Yeah, I'm going to second Xavier. The idea of breaking things is just fun to me. You know, hacking is a lot of that, right? If you have a web form on a website that says, you know, type in your age, and instead of a number, you type in a letter, that's just fun. And to see what the application does. Can I break it? And if you break it, sometimes that can lead to serious vulnerabilities. So I think going along those same lines, that the idea of using applications in unintended means or unintended ways is a way to find security vulnerabilities. And so that's kind of the way I look at it.
Okay. And Rebecca?
Definitely the same as Xavier and Ray in terms of making something work in a way it was not designed for. And I think it covers everything from like old school overclocking CPUs to even social engineering, where you're basically hacking humans. You're trying to pretend you're somebody else to have them do a specific reaction or take a specific task. So I think it's a pretty broad category. I think it's not necessarily the person living in their mother's basement who's head down only focused on a screen in front of them. I think there's a lot of different ways you can identify yourself as a hacker.
I just heard a cat. Okay, Keith.
Okay, whoops. Okay, I just posted some stuff there for some people. I get asked this a lot at DC44. We have people show up all the time asking, I want to hack. What's hacking? So I wrote a web page called How to Get Started Hacking. And hacking in its simplest definition is the process by which you discover the difference between what something was designed to do and what it's capable of. It applies to any subject. You could hack golfing. You could hack computers. You can hack music. It's about the continual learning and exploring, improvising, overcoming, and adapting, not being defined by failure. You're like water. You just find a path. A two-year-old never notices all the time he fails when learning to walk, doesn't pay attention to him. So one of the things you have to do is learn to manage failure and disappointment when things don't go the way you want. It doesn't matter really where you start. Just pick something of interest and start digging. Everything is connected and interdependent, so you'll eventually get to everything else. It's going to take time, so learn to enjoy the process. And one of the things I stress with all our students is ethics. Hacking is a mindset and requires skill. The skills can be used for good or evil. You're going to have to decide how you're going to use your skills. Now, using your skills for evil will unravel the fabric of trust that our very society is based on. And without that trust, people stop making the cool things that we get to explore. So it's very important to maintain that. So you're going to have to choose whether you're going to be the person who just repairs and builds that fabric of trust or destroys it. That's hacking.
Well put. All right, Kurt.
Well, that's been a great set of definitions so far. I think broadly with the panel, I would say for myself that a lot about what hacking is seeing the world for what is possible and not just what is presented to you. That you know, seeing a lock as a puzzle, not a barrier. When something is provided, says it can only be used for this, figure out if it can also be used for that. And it requires a lot of thinking outside of the paradigms, and this, you know, finds abilities as well. Like, that is very intrinsic to the hacking process. is what if you throw out the assumptions of how somebody will use it? So I mentioned earlier, if you ask for a number, but if you look at the available options, and a lot of things work just fine so long as everybody uses them exactly as the original designer imagined. But the truth is that people will not, whether they're hacking to explore, or hacking to do bad, or even just misunderstanding the UI, coming at a different way. And so one of the great abilities of hacking is discovering those things, both for security vulnerabilities so that you can find them, figure out and repair them, or improve the knowledge for the next set of people who are designing, or in order to be able to beat systems and get to do important information. So it's a wonderful mindset of exploring, and a wonderful mindset of not being just accepting that someone says you can only use this for such and such, and you find out that in fact it is an awesome tool. It goes back to like the Captain Crunch whistle, which was designed just to be a toy that makes a note, but it turned out that it was an incredible tool for making phone calls like outside the box. Or some great hacks are very simple. There was back in the 90s when CD music was a thing, people had this whole digital rights management CD. And it was amazing, very difficult to crack, except that if you just took a black magic marker, put it physically on the CD and blocked off crack, then it was entirely gone, defeated by a magic marker. And that's like thinking out the box. It's also the kind of people like in the hacking mentality, you look both ways before crossing a one-way street, because you're not going to assume everything is going to go as it is. So I think I love the hacker mindset. I think also what X-Ray just said about, do it for good, not for evil. I think there's a lot of great power comes great responsibility, to draw from Spider-Man. And if you have these powers, try to use it to make the world a better place.
Okay. All right. Well, the next question is going to be a little switch up from what we've done in the past years. What is your favorite hack that you've done, or hack that you have heard of? So, Xavier.
Favorite hack I've heard, or done. I think that, I don't know. I'm kind of stumped. Anybody else can jump in? I'm sure. I'll think of something.
Go ahead, free for all, whoever wants to answer.
I can think of one. I have to be careful how I share it. We were on an operation and a critical piece of equipment failed. The display failed. And we didn't have a spare on board. And so I was watching the guy who was working on it, trying to figure out what was going on. And I realized that it was a 19-inch rack of equipment, and about 8 U's or 10 U's down below it was an oscilloscope. And so I'm looking at the schematics and I said, hey, where's the scan, horizontal scan generator? Where's the vertical scan generator outputs? So he showed me where they are. And I says, can we wire coax into those locations? So we literally pulled the CRT out of the device and wired coax into the front panel to the X and Y drive and to the Z drive, which is your intensity, brought them out and put them into the X and Y, the O-scope, and the intensity of the O-scope, and then set the O-scope up. And now the oscilloscope was now substituting for the CRT that had been in its place. Now we pulled the signals from before the high voltage section, and then we duct taped over the hole where the display had been. And as a result, we didn't fail the mission. It would have been a fail, go back home failure. So the fun part was when we, on the way back in, we have to announce, radio in when we surface, this is on a submarine, have to radio in and tell them if we have any critical casualties on board that need to be fixed. Casualties not being dead people, but being broken stuff. And we said, yeah, we have this critical piece of equipment is down. There was another one that we did some cool stuff to, but I can't talk about that one. So we radioed that ahead. So when we pulled up the pier and tied up, a guy from the mobile technical unit was there at the pier ready with a toolkit to come down and fix this thing. So when he came down, he walked up to us and said, hey, we hear this thing is broken. And we kind of looked at him and looked at each other and said, well, sort of. And he says, well, is it functional or not? Well, sort of. So he goes in and he looks and sees what we have done to get this thing up and running. And he is absolutely flabbergasted. He cannot believe that we actually hacked this thing to use an O-scope for the display of this thing and keep us from failing a critical mission. So that was one of the ones I really remember. That was fun.
So one of the very interesting hack that I just learned about, and it's a more of a discovery of a hack. So a couple folks on Twitter had just posted this, and Foon, I think if it's pronounced right, basically did a full breakdown. The hack is for pregnancy tests. All right, so pregnancy test, you know, they have the strip, the chemical strip, and based off of the chemical compound in your urine, you will either get one line for not pregnant or two lines for pregnant, and so then you can pay, I think it's like a couple dollars for those pregnancy tests. Then you can go up to I think it's like $8 or $9 to get a digital one. And so somebody of technical mind popped that sucker open and figured out the digital one is basically the same chemical strip, and then it has two digital readers on, or basically little eyes there, and it is digitally reading the line. So basically, you are getting the exact same chemical detector in a digital pregnancy test versus an analog one. And of course, the technical people all were like, look at this, it's a scam, you're spending $8 for something that probably costs 80 cents, anybody can read one line versus two. Overnight, people kind of continued to talk, and what was interesting to find is that actually humans can't read lines as well as computers, and that the accuracy rate of those chemical strips is like 99%. However, you give it to humans and you tell them to read one line versus two, and the reality is only 75% of people get that right. So the digital readers, even though we pay a couple extra dollars for those, ends up being a big plus to making sure that people understand how those work. I just thought it was just marvelously that. Foon, if F-O-O-N-E, I think is how it is on, he does a lot of breakdowns, but this was one of the most fun ones, and I think he's gone on to hack it and was able to like get a little video to run on the screen, and he's continued to go on and do amazing things. But just the reality of how those little digital pregnancy tests work was pretty interesting to me.
Yeah, we were just talking about that today on the DC-404 subchannel on the cybersecurity Discord, and I just posted a Twitter post because you reminded me of it. So, in fact, you probably were part of that conversation. So,
all right, and Rebecca, do you have anything?
Just to reiterate the example that Kirk gave, I definitely remember taking the magic marker and doing my CDs. But it reminds me of one that was kind of later in the 2000s, after Keurigs were developed. And this was like a complete hack for non-technical people. When they went to, I think it was their 2.0 design, they decided to barcode all of the official K-cups, and they would only work, only official cups that are licensed by Keurig could actually work in the machine. And what people did was they would take the little barcode and cut it off and just permanently stick it up on the sensor so it always read it. So you could do your own, make your own pod or some sketchy thing that I don't know people get in the back alleys of Starbucks. I have no idea. But I thought that was absolutely hilarious and a good way of getting around DRM.
All right. And
I can throw one out for you if you like. So, and I can disclose this pub. This was released publicly, so I can speak to this. Like Xavier was having issues. First of all of us have to think about what we can speak about. So this is one of the challenges for all the panelists here. I worked for a small company, a startup around application security, and we were acquired by a very large company. And once I got there, I was able to see the salary and stock options of all 300,000 employees. Once I got there. And the way I found it was that they had their own homegrown HR system, which no longer exists also, so it's safe there too. I was a manager of people, so I had people reporting to me, and we had in their portal where I could go and give raises or look at salaries or give stock options and such, just like any normal HR system. And I thought, you know what, I wonder how tight this thing really is. And so I go over and ask a buddy of mine who worked for the same company, hey, man, what's your employee ID? He gave it to me, no problem. that wasn't a big secret because they're on everyone's ID badges. And so what I did is I intercepted the request to the HR system and just swapped out the employee ID that I was looking for with my buddy's ID who did not report to me. And sure enough, it gave me back all of his salary information, all of his stock options, his work history with the company. And so with that now, I was able to look up anybody I wanted in the entire company. And not only that, that wasn't actually the cool part. The cool part was, okay, well, that's my buddy. How do I figure out what the big guys make, right? How do we get into the executive team? And so I was thinking about, how do I find those guys' employees' IDs? And so there was a portal there. Like a lot of big companies will have maybe a SharePoint or some system that they can all get onto and submit documents or have their own web pages for their different business units. And just out of a hunch, I took my employee ID and put it in the search and hit go. And an Excel spreadsheet came back that had been indexed with every single employee's name and employee ID in it. So now I had the keys of the kingdom for anybody that I wanted to look up. And so that was kind of interesting, where there was quite a few failures in this whole the whole setup there.
Did it expose social security numbers and everything as well?
I don't recall that, if it did or not. I imagine it probably did, since it was all the employee information.
Okay. You got anything, Kurt?
Sure. I was thinking, not as a hacker myself, but, we've advised many hackers over the years. And so I thought I would at least highlight one that we made a lot of press at the time and hit some interesting issues, and that was Barnaby Jack about 10 years ago at Black Hat released demonstrated some vulnerabilities with ATM machines. Jack spotting, I think he was. This was at a time when there were a lot of these ATM machines. You'd see them in like convenience stores or in bars. Not banking ATM machines, but sort of private party ones that were pretty commonplace, and they had some rather terrible security flaws, default passwords. It was kind of a bad ecosystem, and he put together a program that did it, proof of concept of his exploit. I think it was named Dillinger after the great bank robber from the 20s. What was particularly about it was on stage and had an ATM machine that flashed some lights, spewing money onto the stage, which of course unnecessary. You would never actually do that. If you want to rip off an ATM machine, you'd want to be as quiet as possible. But the real point was to draw attention to the security vulnerabilities in that ecosystem and to create something that would make some news and make the people who were doing it pay attention. He demonstrated the flaws against two manufacturers who responded actually reasonably well to that and fixed up, patched the ATMs. But the industry as a whole was filled with these flaws. And so by doing as seen in movies kind of hack and in real life live on stage, brought the got people to take it a lot more seriously in the ATM industry, and I think brought a lot of good to it. Plus, it was really fun to watch.
Anybody else have anything they would like to add or talk about on the same subject, or is everybody done with this one?
I did have thinking of another one. Was a little old school. Was flippies. Anybody remember what a flippy is? So they got the floppy drive, the 5 1/4 inch drives. Basically, you could you take a hole puncher and punch the side of it to be able to then flip it over and use the other side as a drive. You basically buy the discs that would say single sided. Then you would take a hole punch and punch a little hole and make another little dent in the side, and then you could flip it over and use the other side. Basically doubled your storage capacity for free. There's an equivalent hack for the 3 3.5 inch discs, but you had to drill a hole in the specific place. So I remember hacking that, hacking those flippies to get, because every floppy was very critical storage back then. But
okay, all right. So, and another question: how would you suggest that people get started with hacking who have no experience with it whatsoever? Whoever wants to answer, I'll let you answer at your own time.
I would suggest meeting up with your local DC group, like DC 404, DC 770. I've heard rumor of a DC 678, but I don't think I've ever seen where it sells.
Yeah, there is one.
Oh, there is? Okay. Mm-hmm. I keep hearing about it, but I have no idea where it actually takes place. I think that would be a good start, because you can listen to what other people do and get an idea of what's out there and what the possibilities are.
Okay. Anybody else want to go?
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. To find your local teams is definitely there. So there are several good entry points for switching into the security world. And I'd like to point out a couple of them. The most obvious one that a lot of people seek to is starting off as a SOC analyst or a security operations center analyst. And the SOC analyst is a great place to start, because there is kind of a higher turnover there, so there tends to be some good opportunity, and there's a lot of learning on the job, because a lot of the things that a SOC analyst does is fairly repetitive, and you're responding to alerts. You have a certain way that you're supposed to respond, but the teams have a great tiered architecture that allows you to come in as a fairly junior person and learn a whole lot. I am currently running a couple of tools teams, and so I've got a couple of fairly first time to security folks. These are technical people, however, just have not been a part of security. So we run run all the security tools, and so to do that, you really just need to know how computers work. So I've got people that have been in other parts of IT and are switching into the security world. There's a couple of other entry points that a lot of people look at, governance and auditing. There's a lot of different places to go, but you mostly hear about the becoming a SOC analyst. Now everybody wants to be a red teamer. I say there's generally fewer jobs there, but I'll let other people on the board that might know a little bit more about how to get started as a red teamer.
Okay. Ray, do you have anything?
Yeah. So again, like I said, the intro is kind of where I focus on is application security. And the nice thing about this is you guys, anyone watching can get started right after this call and start playing with things. A good resource is OWASP.org, and I'll paste that into the chat here. So that's pretty much everything related to application security. There's a lot of resources where there's purposely vulnerable applications that you can practice on and lessons that show you what to do, what to look for. If you want to try SQL injection, cross-site scripting, a whole host of web application vulnerability type things where you can really learn just on your own and free of charge. All these resources are free. A good application to try, if you want to download it, there's a Docker image as well, which makes it even a little bit easier even for setup. It's called BWAP. So they have a ton of purposely built-in application vulnerabilities into this application, and you're free to hack it all you want. And there's plenty of resources to show you how to do that. YouTube videos, and I'll post that in there as well into the chat. So for application security, it's pretty easy just to start playing with things. And again, it's cheap because it's free. You just go download and play and watch YouTube videos on how to break things in applications.
Okay. Kurt, do you have anything here?
I would say I echo a lot of what other people say is, you know, do it by practicing, by finding your local groups, hacker spaces, maker spaces, as well as the DC area code groups. That's for DEF CON. Maybe go to some of those conferences if you're curious. I've seen a lot of people go there and sort of cut their teeth at conferences by doing capture the flag competitions, which are sort of simulated hacking experiences where you do it competitively. And while at the very top of the CTF game, that is extraordinarily hard to excel at. There are a lot of entry level CTF contests that people can try and get some experience at it. But lots of good opportunities out there. Dustin, I think you're talking but muted.
Sorry about that. Keith, I saved you to the end for a specific purpose. I know you wanted to talk about the King of the Hill a little bit tonight, so I'm going to leave the mic to you right now.
Okay, Network King of the Hill is a CTF. It was developed by another hacker by the name of Iron Geek. And he said, I'm going to paraphrase what he said. It was a little more vulgar. He said, it's a capture the flag for the lazy administrator. The idea of building a capture the flag is that you've got vulnerable machines and there's a flag planted on them. And the idea is you either use a vulnerability or a chain of vulnerabilities to get a foothold on the machine, read out the flag, which is usually a cryptographic hash, and apply it to the scoring engine that gives you points. And the idea is whoever has the most points at the end of the capture the flag wins. If there's a tie, then whoever got to the highest points first wins. That's called a Jeopardy-style CTF. They're probably the most common CTF. It's kind of DEF CON uses. Where Network King of the Hill is vastly different. Well, there's one other. There's one called a Attack Defend, and that's where you're given an image that you bring up, a virtual machine. You run it. It's vulnerable. The idea is you have to attack others and take down their services while keeping yours running, and you get points for doing all that. They have a scoring engine for that. Yeah. CTF time. Canary posted CTF time. That's in my link of stuff that I posted already to the chat. Is a link to that. We host a Network King of the Hill CTF at every DC404 and 2600 meeting. We even do that virtually. We have one of the DC404 members put up a server with a Network King of the Hill capture the flag on it. There are three people who here in Atlanta who are co-developers and one in Nashville. We all meet at either 2600 or DC404 and run these. it's based on standard pen testing vulnerable virtual machines. So we go and get images that are already pre-built for doing pen test training and or challenges. There's, you can get ones that people just do for the challenge of it. You can get them off of a site called VulnHub. The link is in the notes I posted. And we bring up these images. The difference between all the other Capture the Flags and Network King of the Hill is we try to make it as real world as possible. The idea is you have to break into the machine. The scoring engine is looking at some service that serves up content, and you have to plant your team flag in that location so that the scoring engine sees it. And for every minute you manage to stay on the machine, you get a point. Unfortunately, everybody else is also trying to hack the same machines, and they will come in and kick you out and take over the machine. You're allowed to do anything you want to the machines. There's only two rules for it, or three. You're not supposed to attack the host system that's hosting it, which is also running the scoring engine. You're not attack the scoring engine. You don't attack the other players. But as far as what you do on the network, you can attack the network. You can attack the virtual machines, the targets. And if you want to bring your NSA tools and turn them loose, knock yourself out. There are no rules. You go for it. One little caveat. We have a blue team. We have admins that are running it, and they're going to mess with you. They have multiple saved instances of these machines with different configurations, and they can change them out on a whim right out from under you. So it's exactly like being real world. You've got a machine room full of machines. You've got hackers from around the world trying to get a foothold on it and plant their flag. And you're trying not to come to the attention of the local systems administrator who might kick you out. It is a lot of fun. And there's two sides to that. You can either play to get points and play the capture the flag, or you can be one of the blue team guys and actually help defend. So it's just as much fun either way. I've played both sides of it. It's a lot of fun. The key thing to remember, and this is one of the things that is the most daunting for people doing it for the first time, is in your head, we're all Mr. Robot. Kurt's got Mr. Robot on there. We're all Mr. Robot in our head. But when you're actually looking at a blank screen with a blinking green cursor and you have no idea what to do next, that's when you actually have to learn to hack right then. And I don't care if you have zero experience, I encourage you to participate in a capture the flag. The exhilaration, the opportunity to try this, and be absolutely certain that the FBI will not visit you at your home afterwards is absolutely the best fun you can have. And it's also a great hacking and learning experience. There you go.
All right. And we will be hopefully next year looking at having a room to maybe do some CTF, King of the Hill, Capture the Flag for anybody that may be interested. I'm going to throw the mic, so to speak, to the audience. Does anybody have any questions for our panelists at this point?
There was a question earlier about the certified ethical hacker. And so we did some text replies, but I figured to go ahead and reply on voice. Is a certified ethical hacker is a particular certification that's provided by a company. And so to become it, all you have to do is, you pass a test. Of course, it is a red team type, training that takes you through a variety of, different approaches and, trying to get you kind of understanding all the different ways that you could, use these different tools and approaches and in a red team exercise. So it is EC Council, I think is the name of the company. Somebody did post the link there. It is generally looked at as a fairly, basic certification, but it's, going through and learning all of those different skills will definitely teach you a whole lot. And so I wouldn't think tens of thousands of dollars into it. There's lots of different ways that you can get training and get certified, but you know the content there is not too bad. So
one thing I will mention, there is a service called Humble Bundle, if anybody's ever heard of that, which I'm sure some of you have, that commonly does like packages where you might be able to get 5 or 10 books for $5 or $10. So it all goes to a charity. It eludes me which one. But you can get a lot of different IT books. I've seen Certified Ethical Hacker books on there and stuff like that to help you on your journey. You literally don't have to sit here and pay somebody to teach you something that you could very well teach yourself. And that's what it's all about, is learning and making mistakes and fixing those mistakes and then doing it over again.
One of the publishers that comes out with Humble Bundle is No Starch Press. They write or publish a lot of books on computer systems, and including a lot of security-related books. So look for a No Starch Bundle at Humble Bundle, and can pick up a lot of really good books for pay what you want.
All right, so I don't know if everybody in this panel, well, the panelists obviously I know have, but the people attending, if they know what Kali Linux is. So mm-hmm. it is, huh?
I'm just nodding along. Love Kali.
Oh, okay. All right. So it's basically a suite of tools in a Debian-based operating system that is, it's basically script kiddie type stuff, but it can help you on your journey and going through the different exploits, especially using something like Metasploit, and then trying to figure out how to do it manually without Metasploit would be a good exercise to do. I mean, there's all sorts of vulnerabilities you can exploit with various operating systems and be able to, on a Linux system, game root access through FTP, for instance. So, and you can really... Yes, I have a dog named Kali Linux. He's a pug.
Oh, would that be Snort?
But it's just a suite of tools that are very helpful. I would encourage anybody who is interested in it to download VMware Workstation, download some sort of a hypervisor type system, and install Kali and start playing around with it. If you don't know much about Linux at this point, I would not recommend putting it on your primary system. Linux is user-friendly to those who know how to use it, so keep that in mind. And just play with it. Figure out what the different tools do. It has wireless hacking. It's got web hacking, all sorts of stuff. So I would really encourage you to do it. You could even spin up a Docker container and have full-blown Kali inside of a Docker container. So Docker can really be your friend with stuff like this as well, because you can just tear stuff down quickly and rebuild it. So any panelists, do you have anything specific that you would like to talk about? Because we do not have a lot of questions right now, it looks like.
I was going to add the Kali, I think they just ported it over to the new window, or the Linux subsystem for Windows, so you can actually run it in that if you're more familiar with that as a hypervisor. But so Kali and lots of flavors.
Yeah, they're actually, I heard, upgrading the Windows subsystem for Linux to WSL2, which is supposed to have a true Linux kernel as opposed to an emulated one. So I think Microsoft is jumping on the Linux bandwagon, and possibly before long, Windows will be based on a Linux kernel, I hope.
Yeah, that'll it's gonna WSL2 will be a level one hypervisor based on Hyper-V, the Windows Hyper-V infrastructure, and that has some ups and downs. If you turn on any of the hypervisor functionality within Windows, it renders hypervisor two, level two hypervisors dead. So VMware VirtualBox will stop working. VMware and VirtualBox are working with Microsoft to try to continue working with those hypervisor function turns on. But for for now, you just have to turn it off. I would recommend starting with, you have to learn basic sysadmin skills. The better your sysadmin skills, the better you're going to be at it. And the easiest way to do that without buying lots of hardware is, although you can get a lot of hardware for free, there's plenty and plenty of hardware you can get for free. In fact, come to a DC44 meeting or one of the other meetings and ask about that. If you go to my How to Get Started Hacking page, which I posted earlier, it has a section on where to get hardware. The idea is you install VirtualBox, that's the one I recommend, it's free, and you learn how to install virtual machines. You can start by installing a Kali Linux virtual machine from scratch. You can also experiment with installing other operating systems, Windows. At a minimum, you have to learn Windows and Linux. So you can get demo versions of Windows 10 and Windows Server that are demos. They're good for either 90 or 120 days, and you can install them in a VM, so you can actually practice installing them. Learning how to use a virtual machine is like having a hammer and a saw in your toolbox if you're a carpenter. They're absolutely vital to have some type of virtualization technology, that or Docker or something along those lines. You have to learn something like that because it's a tool you're going to use over and over and over while you're learning to hack and using for hacking. For instance, quite often, rather than having to try to run WSL2 with Kali in it on my machine, I just spin up a virtual machine with Kali in my box and use Kali. I know a lot of pen testers don't like using the prepackaged distros like Kali or the one based on Arch Linux or Parrot. There's another one, Parrot. They don't like using those. They prefer to roll their own. They actually build out a base operating system and install the exact tools that they like the way they like them. So that's what happens. But when you first get started, it's better to start with something that's already built, working, so you don't have to struggle with just getting the tools installed just to get to work. So you install a VM of Kali, then you install a VM of a pen test build, and you go to town. You start learning how to scan the network. You start learning how to do that. In fact, we'll be demonstrating that in Hacking 201.
I lost my train of thought. Okay, so there's just a wealth of stuff out there that you can use for hacking. There's a lot of pieces of software that are open source that you can play with and just try to hack the software. Have a game on Linux that you can't get past the level? Well, go look for the config files, find the level, edit the crap that is blocking you, and then lo and behold, you've just beat that level. So there's a lot of different things you can do with open source software that you can't do with the evil Microsoft software.
Excuse me.
Who's saying excuse me?
Hello.
I know C. Stewart had something she wanted to say. She had her hand up earlier.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You're muted. There you go.
I actually asked it in the comments, but I was asking about Security Plus and CCNA and all that, those certifications. If y'all would recommend those.
They look good to prospective employers, that's for sure. And it certainly couldn't hurt. And it gets you book experience. It doesn't get you real life experience. But you can get the real life experience by deploying your own Cisco lab for CCNA. I have one not 2 feet away from me that consists of 8 switches and 4 routers. And I'm off and on working on my CCNP at this point. But yes, definitely get your certifications. There's, as far as I'm concerned, they're as good as a diploma.
Yeah, one of the things I like about the something like the Security Plus is that it introduces you to a lot of different concepts. And this allows you to figure out, is there something that you really, really are interested in? So that you can, you know, there's vulnerability management, maybe it's, you know, application security, you know, security analysts, you know, doing blue team stuff. You know, you get to start to, you know, see how all of these different technologies and or disciplines work, and that, you know, especially in larger companies, you get a lot of very specialized places, and so you can go and just do vulnerability management. You go and work for a smaller company, you're going to get, you're going to need to do a bunch of different things. And so most people that start off, find their home in larger organizations. I can take on that type of person. So as you're going through it, listen to your interests. Not only, finish your Security Plus, that's a great way of kind of demonstrating your knowledge. But then if you're particularly interested in, that'll help you focus your job search when you're looking for, getting into security.
Yeah.
Also, a lot of employers will pay for certifications. So if you have one that will pay for it, take advantage of it, because some of these are not cheap, and you have to either be recertified or you have to get continuing education credits to maintain your certification. So if you go down the certification route, it's not a one and done kind of deal.
Oh, yeah, and if you take a certification test and you fail, you just blew the money on that certification test. You got to pay it all over again to take it again.
Yep.
So make sure you're ready before you go to that exam. I know the CCIE costs thousands of dollars just for the test. You've got to pay for your own hotel, fly out to California, and if you fail the test, well, you're just shit out of a ton of money. So make sure you're ready before you do the certification, by all means. Which CC&E track did I go through? Routing and switching. And that was before they changed at the beginning of this year. So I got it in the end of 2018. There was a question on the forum. What do you recommend to gain experience in hacking embedded systems and FPGAs? I personally have no experience with those, so does anybody have anything they would like to say about that?
Yes. I used to reverse engineer automotive control computers for a living as a contractor. So, in fact, my hacking example was a hardware hacking example. If you're interested in that, there's a group of us within DC404 who are into embedded systems hacking, hardware hacking, as well as FPGAs. If you jump on the Discord and talk to Commager, here, I'll put his handle in here. If you get on the Atlanta Cybersecurity Engineers Discord and ping Commager, he will, he's into that. And there's quite a few other people that are into it as well. So that's one way to get started, is find some other people who are doing that and pick their brains and find out what they're using. FPGAs are rather interesting device for those who don't know what they do or how they work, but I won't go into the details here.
Yeah, that could be a hacking 201 if you want to.
Yeah.
That's my wife, just in case anybody's curious. Okay, so, hello, honey. All right. So, let's see, are there any other questions here? One thing I can add, if you want experience and you want to surround yourself with people, we're not in coronavirus land, if you wish to surround yourself with people who are like-minded, maybe have more experience than you do, find a local hackerspace. I know there, mm-hmm. up here in Glen Burnie where I live, there's a place called Unallocated Space that's probably around 5 minutes from my house. There's a place down in Atlanta. Keith, what is that one called again?
Freeside, Atlanta.
Freeside, thank you. I've been there once or twice.
I posted a link earlier in the chat to a list I have of all the hacker makerspaces in Atlanta area.
Okay. But, I mean, if you're not in the Atlanta area, find one and go from there.
Yep.
I mean, they're a great community. It's a great place to build camaraderie with people. They host, well, at least mine, I can't speak for, say, Freeside or other ones. Mine hosts LAN parties and stuff like that as well, which are fun to go to. Lock picking nights. And we had a lock picking class in Hacking 101 a couple of years ago. Was that one of you guys? Xavier, was that you?
No.
I forget who it was, but it was very interesting how quickly he could pick those things.
Yeah, Atlanta Locksport hosts mm-hmm. the mini Lockpick Village at the DC 404 meetings. Although the virtual meetings, we haven't been doing that very much. However, if you want to get on the Discord, you can chat with all the Lockpick guys. And there's also a Lockpickers United that is a very active international group of lockpicking. That's also a Discord server. Yeah, you'll have to ping me offline, and I'll see if I can hunt the manager down of that list and get an invite for it.
Okay. Well, we're almost done with the hours, so we're at a turning point. Do we wish to go past the hour? Does anybody have anything specific they would like to talk about for Hacking 101?
There's a really good cross-reference that the DoD puts out of all the certifications by area of what you work in, whether you're in a security analyst or a blue teamer or a red teamer, and it breaks down. And these are all the certificates that they look at, that they want you to have one or more of those in order to work in any of those areas. And I've been searching for this link, and I cannot find it. So if I can find it, I can post it to 201 when I get there, if I can find it.
I will say this. One interesting piece of software that I've started looking at a little bit, has anybody ever heard of a piece of software? It's newer. It's called Chasm, K-A-S-M.
No, I haven't heard of that one.
Basically what it is, it's a piece of software that is made for security enclaves that you can basically... what it does is it spins up a Docker container in the background and does, I guess, maybe a no VNC connection to that Docker container and makes it where you can access the internet in places that are locked down so you can't access the internet from there. So it's a way of segmenting the network. And so it has access to it, but it doesn't cross security boundaries where information can be transferred between the internal network and the external network necessarily. It sits on the external network. So it's a very interesting piece of software that I've been playing around with a little bit. So if anybody would like to play with it, I'm putting it out there. All right.
By the way, I'm building a network training lab. I highly recommend you build your own training lab if you don't have one. And if you want to know how to do that, we actually have free classes. So...
I found one of the recent projects I did is to build a pie hole. This was inspired off of one of the Blue Team Village at DEF CON, just kind of an intro on how, you know, putting that together. I'm like, why haven't I done this yet? So $35 gets you a Raspberry Pi 3. Pi hole is software that runs on top of that. It basically is a DNS server, and the goal is to kind of a black hole. That's where the hole comes from, pi hole, and protects you from things like advertising. Trackers. It was interesting to see how much my Roku was sending back to the mothership about all the stuff that my kids watch. And so you can block all of that by $35 for the Raspberry Pi memory card. It takes a couple of minutes to download the OS, and there's some pretty good instructions on how to get that set up. So, as part of setting up lab, that's another little side project. If you want to set up your own DNS server, it doesn't have to be on a Raspberry Pi. You can also run the Pi hole software on pretty much any Linux out there. So, if you've got your own servers, you can do it there as well.
One good resource, Keith posted the certificationkits.com. That's good for if you want to get a full working lab right off the rip. But if you part it out and buy a switch from Craigslist here and a router from LetGo here and stuff like that, you can usually get the parts you need for a lab relatively cheap. Anybody who wants to get serious about virtualization and stuff like that, find yourself a basic server. Load up a piece of software, a hypervisor called ESXi. It's basically an operating system that sits on top of it, and all it's made to do is run virtual machines. And learn how to use that, and then you can make your own home infrastructure. I mean, I've got an ESXi server here, 96 gigs of RAM. I run an Active Directory, Exchange, a Docker server, all sorts of stuff on it. And it cost me, what, $600 when I first got it? So, I mean, they're not expensive. And it would be a good way to get started, because then you could go in and have the resources to deploy darn near anything you'd want to deploy in order to play around with labs. You've got GNS3 for Cisco certification labs if you wanted to go virtual instead of using the real hardware. I would recommend using the real hardware, but if you can't afford that, GNS3 is absolutely free, and it does have some limitations, but you can get through your CCNA with that. You'll need to get images for the routers and stuff like that. It does not provide that. There's also, you can go to recycling centers. There's one in Atlanta called eRecycle USA that I used to commonly go to get routers, switches, servers, stuff like that. People are throwing them out, recycling them. They shredded the hard drives. They're selling the system for rock bottom prices. Otherwise, it's just going to turn into scrap metal. So that's a good way to go about it as well.
I posted the DoD approved baseline certificates link. I found it, and with the help of Canary, helped me find that. And on the Pi-hole, if you're interested in running a Pi-hole, I've been running one for a couple of years. And if you turn on logging, it's going to eat your SD card. Okay, so if you get one of the new Raspberry Pi 3s, the latest model of a Raspberry Pi 3 or Raspberry Pi 4, either one, both of those can be modified easily. In fact, it's part of their configuration to make them boot without an SD card, boot directly from a hard drive. And so what I did is I simply got an old IDE hard drive external USB that I used to have laying around. It was scrap. It was like 10 gigs, which for a Raspberry Pi is plenty. And I put this IDE hard drive in this case, USB, plugged it into the Raspberry Pi, and installed everything to the hard drive and told it to boot from the hard drive. No more messed up SD cards.
What's great about that is I'm sure that your hard drive was bigger than the Raspberry Pi.
Oh, yeah. Right? It actually makes it a great stand to put the Raspberry Pi on top of.
Keeps it warm.
Yeah.
With the Raspberry Pi, you can also do something called RetroPie, where you can look, it's basically an emulation station system that you can load old Sega Genesis and Nintendo and Super Nintendo games onto it. And you don't have to worry about these ones out there that you're bound to just Nintendo or Super Nintendo or whatever, these systems they sell at GameStop and stuff like that. You can run whatever you want on it. And I've had some success up to Nintendo 64. And then after that, the GPU requirement is just too great for it.
Also, if you want to get all the actual joysticks and the buttons and all that stuff, including all the way up to the game cabinet that you can put everything in, they have it at Micro Center.
Oh, they have a game cabinet for it now at Micro Center?
A desktop cabinet, a full standing cabinet, and all the different buttons, controllers, everything for building out a game cabinet with the RetroPi.
And you probably, if you're going to get a, if you're going to get a Pi, you probably want to learn Python, because anything you do on it is usually going to require it. And don't waste your time with Python 2, go with Python 3.
Yeah. And, now I realize there's people here that might not be in Atlanta, and we've been posting a lot of heavy Atlanta stuff.
Yeah.
So what I would recommend you do is if you are in another area and you have no idea where to start. Join one of the other groups here in Atlanta. Tell them that you want to start a group or you need help finding a group. We'll help you. Well, we've helped several other DEF CON groups get started with a CTF. They heard that we were doing a CTF. They wanted to know how to do it. We did a virtual training classes and got them all set up and got the virtual machine set up, got everything done. So we're more than happy to help you learn how to do this and get something started in your area. There's a group called DEF CON Groups. There's groups literally all over the world. So there may be a group in your area. Same with the 2600. And if there isn't one, you can start one. We'll even help you get over the hump of what you got to do to start a group and get it running.
So what do you guys think about the fact that, IBM acquired Red Hat? Do you guys have an opinion on that at all?
Well, I used to work for IBM, so I got an interesting opinion. The a lot of Red Hat, when you call up Red Hat for support, was an IBMer. So it would like it was one of those where it made a whole lot of sense from that perspective, is that the you know, there was already a good chunk of quote unquote Red Hat that was already outsourced to IBM, and so it was wasn't too big of a, you know, culture shift for those that moved over. Some, you know, there always is some bumps in those type of acquisitions, but in the end, I think it made a lot of sense.
Yeah, I was just more worried about them doing something to screw up the CentOS project. So, okay. Well, I think that we can.
I had one thing to add. Typing this in there too. If you'd like to save everything that's been posted in chat, this will save me having to type this. If you look at the top where it says public chat at the top of the window, to the right are three little dots. You can click that and either copy or save, and it will save the contents of the entire chat window. So you can save all the links and all the comments and everything else.
Does anybody else have anything they would like to add? Okay. Well, I'm going to let all of our panelists get on with their evenings here. I don't know if they have any more panels to go to or if they're just going to be relaxing. But I'm going to go ahead and close out 2020 Hacking 101. And tomorrow night at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time is going to be Hacking 201. We will go into more depth. And it is usually a little more of a free-for-all where we can talk about pretty much anything we want. So tomorrow we might have Johnny X returning as a panelist. So I'm hoping he's working on, he's in college right now, so he's working on calculus and some other things. He told me today about he had his first project with Java was simply to write a Hello World application.
How did he do?
I assume good.
Knowing him, he'd say, what language would you like that Hello World to be in?
Mm-hmm.
Or he'd write a Quine, and it would be a program that actually writes the program that puts out Hello World. So
well, that would be good. And my response to him was, why are they teaching you Java? I mean, go to Python, go to C, go to something meaningful. Java is dying. Java is slow. Java should die. A very slow, painful death. Which I think it already is. But anyway, I'm going to go ahead and close everything out for the night. And I will see all of you in Hacking 201. And invite your friends. If you know somebody who's into this type of stuff, have them there tomorrow. We would love to have them involved. Thank you very much for your time. And have a good night.